You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, April 4th, 2018, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
Kara, welcome back from the Amazon.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Are you an Amazon princess now?
I don't know. I don't know what that is.
Wonder Woman?
Oh.
Kind of thing, right?
Were they in the Amazon?
Oh, I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
All right, Kara, cut to it.
It's like a whole other world.
What was
cut
the,
to what?
What was the best part? I mean, how many days were you there? What was the best, the scariest, the funniest?
I don't even know. There's so much. I was there for almost a week. Apparently, it's quite rare, not if you live there, but if you're a visitor, to experience a friaje, which is like a special kind of storm that comes down from the Andes and makes everything a little bit cold. It brings in rain and high winds. And I brought the friaje with me, I guess, because on the boat ride to the lodge where I was staying, we got pretty battered and we couldn't continue on to our lodge. So we had to spend the night at a lodge that took us in. But it was, you know, I think a good initiation into the rainforest. Otherwise, my favorite stuff, I mean, just the wildlife, the biodiversity, it's incredible. And learning from all of the amazing scientists that were there. I was super lucky to go. Rainforest Expeditions is the name of the ecotourism company. They're really great. They're a sustainable ecotourism company where most of the year it's really just scientists and naturalists that are living there and doing research. But they also have a handful of really lovely rooms that are only three walls. One wall is open to the jungle. They're quite rustic, but beautiful. You have everything that you really need, but you still feel like you're out in nature because you absolutely are. And there's three different lodges. I had the opportunity to go to two of them. Refugio Amazonas, which is really beautiful and was just a joy. That's where I was able to see there were certain species. Oh, like agouti. There's a lot more agouti at that species at that location. And then I went farther down river into a much more remote area. Their lodge was called Tambopata Research Center, the TRC. And that is where they have an ongoing macaw program where the scientists have been studying these macaws for years and years. And I met a very nice macaw named Avesita, who is 25 years old and living in the wild.
How long do they live in the wild? Because not as long as in captivity.
Yeah, 40 to 50 years in the wild, 75 years in captivity. That's bananas.
Yeah, for their size, that's huge.
Mm-hmm. And there are maybe 30 to 40 years in the, I mean, there's different ones. So there's like blue and gold macaws, there's scarlet macaws. Avesita was a scarlet macaw. They have these beautiful clay licks there, these colpas. And I went to Colpas Chuncho, which is a large clay lick where basically these animals, because it is the rainforest and just because of, a lot of the ecological factors there, the soil, these animals require a lot more minerals in their diet than can be provided by the food that they eat. So often they flock to these large clay licks where there's a higher concentration of necessary minerals like salts and things, and they feed straight out of the mud. You'll see a lot of butterflies. You'll see a lot of birds there. And so you'll see, dozens and dozens of macaws all flocking to this wonderful clay lick, and you'll hear their amazing sounds and see their colors. Also lots of bugs. I mean, come on. So many bugs in the best way. Ambly Pidgey on my face. A bunch of my friends several years ago when they started going to the Amazon sort of started a tradition of an initiation into the rainforest by putting a massive whip scorpion, tailless whip scorpion on your face. And it looks a lot worse than it is.
Yeah. Oh, it looks bad.
It looks terrible.
It looks bad.
I even if I knew 100% that it wouldn't hurt me, like not on my face.
I was like so excited to do it, like that I went the very first night. I was like, let's go find one and put it on my face.
Let's get this over
with. They were like, whoa.
But Kara, that picture is the beginning of like several science fiction horror movies that I've seen. You know what I mean?
I love it. It's so great. And the funny thing is the picture that I sent you and the picture that anybody who goes to my Twitter or Facebook or Instagram can see, it's actually I posted that because I look the best in it. But the second night, I may have found an even larger Ambly Pidgey and put it on my face. It's just the pictures aren't as, shall we say, photogenic. So I didn't
post that. We understand.
Yeah, so the bug photo bombed you, basically.
Yeah.
Okay.
And Kara, speaking of bananas, did you sample any?
Oh my God,
I had tons of bananas. I think they're called lady fingers there. Mm-hmm. I don't know what that's the, what actual species, though, that is the common name for. They're small.
The lady finger, it says Southeast Asia and Australia. That's the origin. Yeah, those are tiny ones. Those are probably similar to the ones I had in Hawaii.
Yeah, they're small and they're super sweet and they're delicious. And in all the lodges, they had these wonderful kind of banana safes, almost like a pie safe, where you could just walk up and it was netting all around it so that the mosquitoes and the bugs don't get to them. And it's cool because it's just like how they grow on the trees. It's just like a whole bushel of them inside of there.
Well, I would love to do that. That sounds like a wonderful trip.
Oh, my gosh. I'm telling you, you guys should go. It's really great. It's, and as I mentioned before, I think I started to mention, I was there during science season, which is a couple weeks in the wet season, kind of coming into dry season, when Rainforest Expeditions really welcomes and encourages people who are super interested in participating in citizen science to come. And they have all these great programs through their Wired Amazon project. So you can participate in helping to identify healthy castanea trees, which are Brazil nut trees, which are really, really important to the local economy. You can help try and look for jaguars on camera traps. You can go out to light traps at night and collect tiger moths to try to identify new species. And I think since they've been doing it in the past couple years, they've already identified 11 new species, and they often name them for the visitors to the lodge, which is super cool. Yeah, it's just a lot of fun. Oh, and by the way, monkeys. Many incredible monkeys with incredible calls. Second time I've ever seen primates in the wild other than humans.
Wow.
So it was like really exciting experience for me for sure.
All right, Kara, get us started with What's the Word?
Okay, so this week's What's the Word was recommended by Duncan Margetts from Adelaide, South Australia. And the word is atavism. Ooh, I say it every week. This is a fun one. But it really is. Have you guys, I know that Steve has, because he is the one who approves the words that I pitch each week. But other guys, have you heard this word before?
Sure.
Atavism?
Sure. It's fairly common, I think.
I've heard it.
Yeah, but I feel like it's one of those words that you kind of encounter a lot, but contextually might not quite know what it means. It's got a very kind of firm scientific definition, but it can also be used in a sort of poetic way, which I love.
I used to use the word a lot, and then I stopped, but now I'm going back to it again.
Let me guess that that's kind of
yeah, you're about to understand that joke, you guys. All right, so an atavism is actually a trait or a character in an organism that was ancestral and then recurred, usually due to some sort of mutation, due to a genetic recombination. So what happens is that when organisms evolve over, well, I guess in bacteria it could be hours, but most organisms over, you know, hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years, morphologically, the phenotype changes. But that doesn't always mean that the kind of code that's in the DNA goes away, that tells the body map to produce something, you know, that used to be produced. So a really good example of this would be like a human tail. Now, there's two ways that people can end up with tails. You've probably all heard of, you know, people having tails, right?
I've heard story about tails. Yeah.
Yeah, you've heard stories about it, or maybe like in the medical literature, or you've seen like cool pictures online. So there's something called a pseudo tail, which actually is not an atavism. It's just some sort of projection that happens to happen in the same region where a tail would form. But there's also a tail, a true tail, that happens. It's quite rare. And it's kind of a projection of the coccygeal region of the spine. And this is because in utero, and of course, historically, we had tails. Like, our ape-like ancestors had tails, and eventually we lost those tails. And so what happens is that still within the code, the DNA code, somewhere in there, there is this map, this information, this blueprint to make a tail. But throughout sort of the development of actually the organism in utero, there's a series of apoptosis events, you know, where those cells die and we don't end up with a tail once we're born. But every so often, because of some sort of mutation, a person may actually be born with a tail. Another really popular example in the literature, and it's actually the example that helped scientists really understand what atavisms are and that they are a real thing, because they were proposed a long time ago, but there wasn't a lot of good evidence to support it, is the example of teeth in chickens.
Yeah.
And so there have been a lot of great studies where organisms have actually been engineered to, or back engineered to have these teeth expressed. And so we can now see through this genetic manipulation, instead of waiting for the fluke to come along, that this was an ancestral trait, obviously, like dinosaurs had teeth, in chickens, which is super, super cool. And then I think my favorite example, mostly because I weirdly have a lot of male friends who have this, is supernumerary nipples.
Ooh.
Do any of you have supernumerary nipples?
Nope, just got two.
Nope.
Just two.
Last time I checked.
Sometimes people don't know that they have them because, like, it looks like a little birthmark or something, but it happens to be in line with the nipples, and oftentimes that's an indication. It's, I don't know, it's super cool. So let me see. The root of the word, atavism is one of those words where we actually have a pretty good idea of who coined it. It was 1833. A French botanist named Antoine Nicolas Duchesne. And the idea was, I love it when scientists who coin terms actually look to the Latin and want to make sure that the term has a sort of etymological basis and not just like, oh, this is a Duchesneism. Right? They like name it after themselves. But anyway, so the word atavism comes from the Latin atavis, which is made up of at, meaning beyond, and avis, which refers to kind of grandfather. The earlier roots of it are really like a male relative that's not your dad. So it could be uncle, could be cousin, could be whatever. But avis, I think specifically there, refers to grandfather. And so the idea here is that this is a trait that didn't happen in your parents and didn't happen in your grandparents. It has to have existed beyond your grandfather and then reemerge within that generation. So there have to be several generations distance for it to kind of qualify as an atavism. It went away and it came back through some sort of genetic quirk. Mm-hmm. Super cool.
Yeah, so like if a dog displayed a feature that was lost from wolves, that would be atavistic.
Yeah, and I think that they do. Like whales. Whales sometimes have back feet.
Mm-hmm.
That's an atavism. But I think the beautiful thing about it, too, is that you can use the term in a more poetic way. So an atavism is a throwback to a previous form or a previous era or previous type. And I love that. I love these scientific terms that have made their way into common parlance and into sort of like literary parlance, because I think it just gives so much more breath and so much more life to our lexicon.
Yeah. Let's go on to some news items. So more fear-mongering about cell phones and cancer.
No.
This is just one of those topics that we're never going to be rid of. There was an article recently in the Nation, which is a left-wing political paper. But the article was basically fear-mongering about cell phones and the risk of developing cancer. I thought actually they did a terrible job. They tried to say, oh, we're not saying that cell phones cause cancer. We'll let the scientists decide that. We're just saying that the telecom industry is hiding evidence that cell phones cause cancer.
Okay.
It was really a bad piece of work. But a lot of this is coming from a recent study that was published that was in rats. This is the National Toxicology Program study. They actually released their preliminary findings a couple of years ago.
because they said, oh, this, you know, we have some preliminary analysis and there's a lot of public interest in this, so we want to get the results out there before, you know, it would take a couple more years to get all the full data and analysis out there. And they purported to show that there was a connection between exposure to the kind of radiation that's used in cell phones and cancer risk. And then more recently, we got the full data. There's still some, you know, findings in there that you can cherry pick if you want to make an argument that there is some risk, but the data is basically negative. So let's delve into that, because this is, you know, given a lot, this study, the NTP, the National Toxicology Program study, has given a lot of fuel to the cell phone cancer alarmists. And so it's important to evaluate it. So first of all, this is a study in rats and mice. They basically had four groups of test animals, male rats, female rats, male mice, female mice. So they were exposed to radio frequency radiation for 9 hours a day, every day for 2 years, starting in utero. And then they looked at multiple different types of potential cancer, essentially anywhere in the body, in these four groups, you know, the male, female rats, male, female rice, mice. What do you think they found?
Precancerous nothing? Something, maybe.
So I guess
they must have found something if everybody's reporting on it correctly.
Yeah, they found some.
They found something because they were looking at so many different potential correlations, right? As we've discussed before, like every time you do a comparison in a study is another throw of the statistical dice, right? It's another opportunity to find a correlation, especially if you're using like 0.05 p-value as the threshold for statistical significance. That's not that much. So if you do the calculations, there was actually like an 80% chance that something was going to be significant in this study, just based upon all of the different comparisons that they made. So it's not surprising that they found some correlations. If you correct the statistics for the fact that they made multiple comparisons, they were not statistically significant. Further, you have to look at the pattern, right? Especially when you're doing a toxicology study, you're trying to say, is there any hazard from this exposure? Is there any correlation there? What you'd like to see is a consistent dose response effect. That lends a lot of credibility to it. The absence of a good dose response type of pattern makes it seem like the results are random noise. In this study, they found a positive correlation for malignant gliomas. That's a type of brain cancer, but only in the male rats, not in the female rats, not in the male or female mice. They also found a positive correlation for cardiac schwannomas. Cardiac schwannomas.
What? Schwannomas?
Schwann cells. Yeah, those are glial cells in the brain.
Oh, okay.
Again, only in male rats, not in any of the other three groups. But also, if you compared the highest exposure to the lowest exposure to the no exposure groups, it was not statistically significant. It only becomes statistically significant if you do this certain kind of analysis where you look at all the different exposure levels and see if there is a trend, right? So you look at the 6, 3, 1.5, and 0, and you say, oh, yeah, if you compared it, there was three cases of cardiac schwannoma in the group exposed to 6 watts per kilogram, none in the other three groups. And so you do two different kinds of statistical analysis on that. One is positive, one is negative, right? And just the straight up comparison of this 6 watt per kilogram group to the 0 watt per kilogram group was not statistically significant. So all of that is consistent with random noise, right? You guys see that? How it's like, oh, it's in one sex, but not the other. Why the heart versus something else? You know, only if you do certain kinds of statistical analyses, but not others. There's no dose response curve. You're talking about just a few rats. You know, that could one random, you know, rat getting a tumor is really all it would take in order to create results like this. This totally has the look of random noise. There is no clear signal in this data.
And therefore, horrendous health effects in humans.
Yeah. So if anything, this study is pretty reassuring evidence that the radiation from cell phones, is not a hazard for cancer, right? Because they had these rats and mice exposed for 2 years from utero.
6 hours a day.
9 hours a day, whole body exposure 9 hours a day.
Full-time job.
Yeah. So yeah, basically we're exposed to it in their cage.
So under these extreme conditions, you get noise.
You get random noise. Yeah, there's no clear signal of any kind of cancer. But, of course, if your narrative is that cell phones cause cancer, you could pull out the apparent, you know, significant effects without putting it into the context of doing an actual thorough statistical analysis by accounting for multiple comparisons, right? So it's fake. It's just not a real, it's not really significant. It just is only significant if you ignore the full evaluation, right? If you cherry pick.
So did they not correct for the number of contrasts they were doing?
No.
No. How did this get past reviewers?
Yeah, exactly. So, all right, I think the reason is that there's a difference between hazard and risk. This is actually a good discussion.
Oh, that's right.
Like between subject and target. I get it.
So a hazard, a good example of this is...
I got that, Bob.
Good boy. If you have a poison under your sink, in your kitchen, that poison is a hazard. But it's only a risk if you drink it. There's no risk to you just from it being there. It's a hazard because it's a potential to have a risk, but there is no... Anyway, so toxicologists like to identify potential hazards. And so they do studies in such a way to say, is there any possibility here that of a biological effect? They're not asking the question, is there a biological effect or a risk of one in real life exposure situations? That's a different question. So this study is really just asking about hazard, not risk. They're not asking what's the risk of using a cell phone. They're asking, is there any hazard to cell phone radiation? And then even in that far more limited sense, the answer appears to be no. It's an overall negative study. So even for hazard, which in and of itself, I mean, there's lots of things that are hazardous, like sharks are hazardous, but I'm at zero risk for sharks. Yeah. You know, if you go swimming in a tank with a shark, that's risky. Does that make sense?
Oh, sure.
So, but this hasn't stopped people from fear-mongering about cell phones and cancer. Now, the problem with the Nation article is that it really is taking on a particular narrative, which, you know, I hate narratives because it's basically, you know, it is a story that then is put above the facts, logic, and evidence. And I'm already seeing this narrative parroted in the comments on our Facebook page when we published to our science-based medicine article on this. People are just parroting the narrative as if it's like an original thought to them. Always embarrassing. So the narrative is that big telecom is doing the same thing that big tobacco did with the risk of smoking tobacco and that the fossil fuel industry did in terms of global warming, and that they're trying to sow doubt and confusion about the risks of cell phone use. And they also said, plus they're about to do this big 5G rollout with even a more, you know, more radiation, a massive radiation increase. And they're trying to hide the risks from the public, et cetera, et cetera. And this is the kind of evidence that they're cherry picking in order to make that narrative. So, again, I never assume that any industry or any company is benign. I think we have to keep an eye on them. Absolutely. They're in the business of making money. They can or cannot choose to be good citizens. And we never give them an assumption that they are, right? So, but there's no reason to think that the telecom industry is hiding actual data showing that there's any risk to cell phone use. And we have lots of independent evidence showing us that there isn't, that are very reassuring. You know, just the mere fact that there hasn't been any increase in brain tumors over the last 30 years when cell phone use has increased dramatically. And of course, the more time that goes by, the more reassuring that data becomes because, you know, initially you could say, well, there's a lag. There's a 5-year lag, a 10-year lag, a 20-year lag. Okay, well, it's been 20 years, yeah. You know, since the 1990s.
It's like the lack of UFO photos from cell phones.
Yeah.
Where are they?
I know, it's hard to make the negative statement, but the longer you go with a lack of any signal, a lack of any effect, the more reassuring it gets. You could never say the risk is zero, but you could say the risk is so low at this point that I wouldn't worry about it.
Right. I mean, the point is, with the amount of people that use cell phones on a daily basis globally, it's over a billion. It's got to be over, you know, a seventh of the population, if not dramatically more than that. We would absolutely know, I think, at this point, if there was something going
on. In developed countries, it's like 90% of adults. So
Yeah, and even in developing countries, it's a really high percentage now. Like, it's cheaper and easier to get a cell phone than it is to have clean water in many areas.
Yeah.
Wow. And to compare it to something like tobacco, for which there's so much evidence of the harmful
effects that's the difference.
And cancerous agents. It's such a contrast, but they use it. It's the boogeyman. They have to invoke it in order to give it legitimacy, nothing else.
So anyway, don't worry about it. You know, if you hear, oh, there is this study which shows, you know, that cell phones are associated with cancer. It's not true. This is actually a very reassuring study. You know, this rat study. They it's like they did everything they could to give these rats, you know, cancer from cell phone radiation, and they got nothing. They got basically a negative study, with just the absolutely statistically expected noise, random crap that you would expect from this kind of study.
They'd get more radiation eating a bunch of bananas than they would being exposed to.
Well, yeah, right. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, there's so many other sources of radio frequency. Electromagnetic, you know, effects in our environment. Cell phones are actually quite negligible. And I have to point out that it's non-ionizing radiation.
Right.
Yep,
still
doesn't penetrate the skin. Mm-hmm. Thank
you. Yeah, so the plausibility of non-ionizing radiation causing cancer by any mechanism, you know, you can't say that it's zero just to be, you know, a conservative scientist, but it's pretty damn freaking low. You know, it's ionizing radiation, yes, because it causes mutations. It could break bonds in molecules like DNA. Non-ionizing
or turn you into a superhero or a villain.
Oh, nice qualifier there, Bob. Super villain.
Or villain.
Right. But, you know, this is obviously something that will be continued to be followed, to be studied.
I mean, Bob, if your cell phone made you into a superhero, what would your lame power set be?
Right.
Good cell phone reception.
Download app.
I mean, you could text, like instantaneous text into somebody's mind. What?
Candy Crush power.
Fast recharge.
All right.
Pretty lame.
Bob.
All lame. Really.
All your teeth will turn blue. That's for sure.
Bob, I love the title of your news item that you're going to talk to us about. Robot bees on Mars.
Yes.
Sounds like a thriller from the 50s or something.
So you guys heard of snakes on a plane? How about bees on Mars?
Based on the true story.
So NASA has awarded funding to a University of Alabama researchers and an unnamed team of Japanese researchers to develop a swarm of robotic bees as a new type of Mars rover. So I love robotic swarms. I don't try to hide that fact. It seems pretty easy, pretty obvious to me that they're going to serve a critical function in the future. They're just so cool.
Oh, yeah.
and helpful on so many levels. So in this case, the need that's being potentially filled may seem counterintuitive because Mars rovers have been among the most successful off-world robotic missions in history. Right? You've got Mars Pathfinder, Sojourner, Exploration, Curiosity. They all killed it. They just did so well and lasted so much longer than they were meant to. Learned so much science from them. And they were obviously a huge advantage over the very early Mars landers. Remember the landers? They pretty much wherever they landed, that's where they stayed. And for obvious reasons, because the rovers can move to different locations for scientific examination, or they could just move to a good spot in the sun to recharge their batteries. So they're awesome. But still, they have a problem. They're not very speedy, and therefore they're limited to how far they can go. So if you really want to do some really long-distance scientific investigation of Mars, you need something that's a little better, a little faster, whatever. So NASA's looking for the benefits of tiny flying rovers, if you will, to see what they would allow. So what are the options for a flying rover-type technology? Well, you've got fixed wings, right? Fixed wings technology, like little airplanes. That would work, but hovering is going to be a problem. Then there's rotor tech, little mini battery-operated helicopters or drones, of course, that have exploded into our reality the past dozen or so years. How awesome are drones? Everybody loves drones. They're going to start doing anything. You may have a drone flying car in the future. They're just everywhere.
Well, not the people who are killed by them, but yeah, pretty much everybody else.
True. So, but then there's also good old-fashioned flapping technology, robotic birds, or since they'd be very tiny, robotic bees. And so NASA thinks that this could potentially be the best option, which is why they're risking about $125,000 for this phase one study to see if this is worthwhile on what they're calling Mars bees. I think they could have come up with a
Mars bees.
Yeah, Mars bees. I guess maybe it'll grow on me.
It sounds like a pancake company.
Mars bees.
Or yeah, it sounds
like
totally.
I'm gonna go have me some Mars bees.
I thought it was like a group from the '60s or something. No, the Mars bees.
No, it's more like they're like little jelly bean like candies. Mars bees. I want some Mars bees.
Yeah.
I'd eat those.
Right. Is there peanut butter in them? Oh.
So they're looking into flapping. They think that's even worthwhile because you could take advantage of various low power, incredibly efficient technologies that use just flapping. But it's kind of surprising if you think about it, because this is despite the fact that Mars has an incredibly thin atmosphere, which makes flapping much less efficient than it would be on Earth. Right? Think about it. Mars, the atmosphere on Mars is what? Is it 100 times thinner, or is it 1,000 times?
I think it's 1/100.
Yeah, I think it's 1/100. Something like that. Incredibly thin atmosphere. So how the hell is something that flaps, or even anything that has even a fixed wing or rotor, how is that going to even do well in such a thin atmosphere? But don't forget, the gravity on Mars is fully 1/3 that of Earth. So that's the real icing on the cake there. That gives any flapping technology a huge advantage, even overcoming the paucity of atmosphere on Mars. So the idea then is this. You have a normal-sized lander or even a mobile rover that would act primarily as a communication hub. So that that lander would communicate with the swarm, the bee swarms, and also back to Earth, presumably. And it would also be used, probably more importantly, as a recharging station for the swarm. So they would go out and do their thing, and then they would come back as the juice is getting low and situate themselves, plug into the lander or rover, and recharge their batteries.
I hope they call it the hive.
Nice. Yeah, the hive lander or the hive rover. Now, the bees themselves would be about American bumblebee sized. You see how my qualifier there? I did not know that the American bumblebee is about 25% as large as the biggest bumblebees that exist. I'm not sure where they are, and I'm not sure I want to go there.
They're probably the Amazon.
Yeah, I was thinking that.
Probably in Borneo or something. I don't know.
So these would be bumblebee-sized, but they would have oversized cicada wings, because they'd have to be bigger because of the thin atmosphere. They'd have to be a lot bigger than a conventional bumblebee. And still, it won't be a cakewalk for the bees. They'll have to do a suite of things. They'll have to fly well in an alien environment. But also, the bumblebees will have to carry sensors that can do real work and not just take, you know, low-res pretty pictures. You need some sensors that might have some, you know, they might need to have some heft to them to be good sensors. And anything with weight is going to be your downfall for such something like this. But then again, gravity is low there, so maybe you can get away with something bigger. And also, the bees would have to do things like somehow clean the dust off themselves. You don't want that to messing up the works, so they'll have to be able to clean themselves. But if it all works, though, and they think it could take 10 years for this design and this research to see if it's even feasible. But if it does work, they'd be able to cover terrain much faster than anything that's ever been on the surface of Mars before. They're even talking about using them to sample the atmosphere in Mars, looking for methane, which of course, as we know, is a hallmark of some biological processes. So it's be cool to see where this goes. I thought we were kind of farther along. I mean, I've been seeing these robotic winged, robots for years and years and years. I would think that we'd be, and I haven't seen anything in a while. I would think that we'd be, really farther along than my research led me to believe. I mean, 10 years of research before they think they'll have something. I mean, that's such a long time. But yeah, I guess I'm used to waiting for cool new technology.
Always waiting, Bob. Right?
Yeah.
Hey, Bob.
Yo.
In case you're interested, the largest bumblebee is often called a flying mouse by locals.
Whoa.
And damn. It exists.
Where's locals?
It exists near Patagonia. It is, of course, endangered.
Oh, God.
Aww.
Wah, wah. I know. It's beautiful, though. It's like a beautiful reddish brown and like fuzzy looking. Wow. Bombus dalbomi.
The flitter mouse.
Isn't a Dumbledore a bee?
Yes, right? Dumbledore is a type of bee.
I think it is, yeah.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
That's where she got the name from.
Huh. No way, that's awesome.
Dumbledores and bumblebees.
They are fragging huge. That's scary. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's just an old English term for bumblebee.
Yeah, it's a rare term for a kind of bee.
I can't deal with freaky big insects on my face, for Christ's sake, Kara.
Oh, they're wonderful.
Jay, what about large dinosaurs? Welcome them into your
life. I love large dinosaurs.
All right, Evan, tell Jay about the largest dinosaur.
Well, what do you know, Evan?
The sauropod?
What have you been talking about?
Sauropods? Sauropods are the largest dinosaurs, land roamers that they were they not?
Of course.
And of course, there is news about sauropods emanating from, of all places, the Isle of Skye in Scotland. Jay, that's where they invented Skype, you know.
Oh, and I know in Skypeland? Skype, so.
In Skye. Isle of Skye. No, seriously. Look at some of the pictures of Isle of Skye. Take a look at it for a moment. It's beautiful. It reminds me of some of the scenes from The Last Jedi movie, if you know what I mean.
Is it S-K-Y-E?
S-K-Y-E. Skype without the P.
Yeah. It is beautiful.
It is beautiful. Among the many features of the Isle of Skye are its muddy, shallow lagoons on the island's northeast coast in an area called Brothers Point. And among the many features of these muddy, shallow lagoons on the northeast coast of the Isle of Skye are these footprints. Now, not just any footprints. These are fossilized prints of sauropods. Yep, and not just one or two footprint or feet print, if you like, but hundreds of these prints and multiple distinct tracks of them. It is nothing short of perhaps the most significant paleontological discoveries in all of Scotland. Yep. But what made this particular discovery so newsworthy recently is the age of the prints. They are estimated to be between 164 million and 174 million years old, and that puts it in the middle Jurassic period. And according to the experts, sauropod track finds of this kind are very rare. And not just because they're footprint fossils, but any fossils, I read, that from the middle Jurassic are considered to be a precious find. And all of this is thanks to researchers from Edinburgh University, and the findings were recently published in the Scottish Journal of Geology. The lead author of the paper, graduate student Paige DiPolo, she explains that this track site is the second discovery of sauropod footprints on Skye. It was found in rocks that were slightly older than those previously found at Duntulum on the island, and it demonstrates the presence of sauropods in this part of the world through a longer timescale than previously known. Co-author of the paper, Stephen Broussait, added that there are probably thousands of tracks if you could trace the layer of rock underground and out into the water. There are tracks everywhere. This just wasn't some lonesome dino walking through this lagoon. My guess is that the layers span at least 1,000 years.
Oh, wow. Nice.
Yep. So, really significant find. And it was one of Dr. Broussait's graduate students, his name is David Foffa, who discovered the first tracks in 2016, while he and some other paleontology students were exploring the coasts, and they were looking for bones and teeth, primarily. But amid the tidal pools, he had found a large impression that had been colored pinkish-purple by algae. And upon closer inspection, he discovered the outlines of toes and a fleshy heel pad, and it turned out to be a sauropod footprint, first of many to be discovered in the area.
What a find.
Now, these prints are not easy to find, not easy to study, let alone find. I mean, the tidal conditions of the region were and are challenging, to say the least. The landscape has undergone changes in recent years, and all the impact of weathering and erosion make these things very tricky to discover. And then to try to get out there into these regions to measure them and take your samples and everything else you have to do, it's a challenge. It's not an easy thing to do. But they were able to accurately measure the prints. And they did so using some interesting technology. To scan the tracks during the low tides, which is the main time when you can get out there to see them, DiPolo invented what she calls the intervalometer, which are two offset cameras mounted on an easily portable pole.
What was that? Interconfabulator? What was that?
Intervalometer.
Oh, gotcha. All right.
So it's how it's described as how our eyes, our two eyes, allow us to see depth. These two cameras allowed her to, and a colleague, to map the trackways in 3Ds as they walked around the area. And the team also used a drone, drone technology, to get aerial images of the site. Yep, another brilliant use of drones. Thank you. But despite the challenging climate of the region, the latest discovery helps cement that the Isle of Skye is a key region for bringing this little understood era to life. So big news from Scotland.
But their estimate of the size of the dinosaur is based entirely on the footprint. They haven't found the actual bones of this dinosaur.
No, they have not found any remains, any bones. It is all in the footprints. The largest being about 2 feet in diameter. So they didn't find the actual largest sauropods that have been measured or existed. In fact, this was pretty early on in sauropod evolution. Some of the earliest known times in which the sauropods were around. So they were on their way to becoming the colossus size that they ultimately did become. So this is early on in that process.
Right. Right.
So, cool. So it's just got to be like a freakish circumstance where, the animal was walking on some type of substrate where something happened where it got preserved.
Or Jay, actually, they're saying that they moved around probably a lot more than maybe was previously thought. They would kind of what a person would do when you just wade out to your ankles in the water and kind of splash around in the shallows, that the sauropods were apparently doing just that. So they weren't locked into these specific spots. These were among the places where they would go to hang out.
But yeah, so it's a combination of, Jay, what you're saying is it's a combination of what they were walking on, right, held their impression,
yep.
Mm-hmm. And then was covered at some point in such a way that the impression, solidified and fossilized, So it's just,
protected, yes.
Yeah,
well,
they were later protected, and now they also have to be revealed at the surface. So, yes, it's an unlikely sequence of events, but because there's so many different parts of the world, some part of the world that's, at every point, any given point in time, some point in the past is being exposed in some part of the world somewhere. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
This is a window into an era that we don't have a lot of windows into, which is why the data is so interesting.
Yeah, whether it's the case of footprints or even actual fossilized bones where they've been kind of remineralized and formed by these geologic processes, like, it's rare. It's crazy rare when you really think about it. Like, it's such a small percentage of the living organisms that ever existed. And I think it's, like you're pointing out, Jay, it's so important to remember that. That's why the fossil record is so, so thin. Even the kind of embarrassment of riches that we have is just a teeny tiny fraction of a fraction of what existed.
All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
Okay, last week I played this noisy. So, what do you think?
I heard wind towards the end of it.
Well, it's drumming of some sort.
A good chunk of guesses this week. Glenn Bristol guessed this week's noisy sounds like someone drumming with their fingers on an aluminum fence post.
Okay. Mm-hmm, okay. It's very specific.
Yep, that's not correct. Brandy Hernandez guessed, "Hi, y'all. Been listening for 6 months here in Oakland and happy I stumbled upon the podcast. This sounds like a marimba. I took cultural anthropology in high school in 2009, and our teacher had a marimba and was so excited to whip it out." Yeah, it's not a marimba.
Okay.
That's a funny phrase.
And then longtime listener Evil Eye wrote in, "Raindrops in a rain catcher hitting the bottom and sides."
Oh, that's cool. Clever. I like that, even if it's not right.
Thank you, Michael. That's not correct either. But there were some very good guesses, or people were guessing this, like, similar things. Many people guessed the gamelan drum from Indonesia. Gamelan drum from Indonesia. That's not it either. This is a cool one. So this was sent in by a listener named Emmy Lem. Check this out. This is called a gavel dash, And it's actually a musical stone, which only can be found in Gobistan, Azerbaijan. So what this is, that typically what happens is people find these stones, and then they, when they're struck, they make a tone. Musical sounds come from them, and these stones are called gavaldash. And a lot of people say the sounds can be compared to a tambourine, even though I'm not really hearing it. Maybe just the hard drum of a tambourine, not the kind of tambourine that has the the little symbols on them. I found it very difficult to find good information about this. Like, how are these symbols created? Yeah. Why are they resonating? What's happening? They're saying, though, they're formed during a combination of unique climate, oil, and gas, which can be found in the region of
Azerbaijan.
Very cool. You know, in the video, someone went up and struck the stone. And each time they struck it, it made that resonating sound. You know, like, I would love to see a real physicist take a look at this and tell us what's going on, or a geologist take a look at this and tell us what's actually going on. There has to be,
as opposed to a fake physicist or geologist.
You know what I mean.
We don't want them to.
Just not an average person going over and, you know, what's actually ringing in the stone? Like, how is it vibrating through the stone? This next noisy, I don't even know how to preempt it. It was sent in by a listener named Carolyn Boyd. I just laugh every time I hear this.
You know what this is?
I know, it's not me.
It's Jay getting out of bed in the morning.
It sounds like you, Jay.
It's not me. What is it, Kara?
What is it,
Kara?
It's eight J's overlapping.
And the reason I think that it makes us laugh so much is that, like,
oh, I know what it is.
It's a type of apophenia. Like, any time, or pareidolia. Like, any time that there's, like, some sort of animal or some sort of environmental sound, or even a mechanical sound that sounds remotely human, it's like weird, uncanny valley. Like, we go to this very human place. We find human sounding patterns.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And it
absolutely
makes us laugh our asses off because
it's so funny.
Like a dumb drunk kid.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yes.
There is just something so epically humor. Like, it's so freaking funny to me. Just listen to it again. Listen to this.
Jay, I know what it is.
It sounds like somebody pretending to sound like something aggravated and semi-evil.
You know? You know what it sounds like?
What,
like an AI.
It sounds like an Aztec death whistle.
Yeah, like,
it's not an Aztec
death whistle. Aztec death
whistle. That's one of my favorite noisies of all time.
Oh,
by the
my
way,
God.
Bob. Yeah.
But yeah, that has that same kind of thing.
Or
like the animals that talk, you know, it's like almost human. Or even when we just hear like weird noises that are within the human kind of voice register, we put a lot of very human traits to them. And this is which I'm assuming is not human.
Carrie, you're right though. I mean, you know, I've heard like the goats that sound semi-human and they're funny as well. But this one, I listened to about 5 minutes of it, and I picked out what I thought was the funniest part. Or if you've heard anything equally as funny this week, please email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
Thank you, Jay. Couple of, one not so quick emails. About a gazillion people emailed us to correct my math mistake that I made on the...
Steve, you know what noise they were making?
Yeah.
Wow.
So I was talking about the rice blast fungus and how it can wipe out 30% of the rice crop every year.
Wow.
Right? So yeah, so if you, and then I said, and if we got rid of it, we'd get that 30% back, or increase it by 30%.
Right.
Which, you know, I was thinking we'd get that 30% back, but I said it would increase it by 30%. But of course, if you decrease the amount by 30%, then you increase by the same amount. It's not a 30% increase. It's a 42.9% increase. And all of the math pedants in our audience decided to write me at the same time and explain that to me.
Well, cool. They passed the test. Nice. Good job, guys.
Yes.
Yeah, right. that was totally on purpose.
Yeah.
Right. Oh, yeah. Okay. The next one is, I got a the half a gazillion emails about the interstitium science or fiction topic from last week.
Yes.
But this one definitely needs an update. So if you recall, one of the science fiction items last week was that scientists have discovered a new organ that is a series of fluid-filled cavities under the skin in the connective tissue. And that was science. But of course, there's been a lot of developments on this story since we recorded the show last week. And of course, as we remind our listeners, 3 days goes by between the time that we record the show and when the show comes out, and stuff happens in those 3 days. This is not a news item. This is a science or fiction item, which means that the item just came out, and there really hasn't been any. So every now and then, like, I'll cover a topic. Usually I try to avoid ones that I think are going to be, like, I want to see the reaction of the community.
Yeah, they'll be picked apart, right?
Yeah, but this one I just thought I wanted to talk about. I thought it'd be interesting. And so I reported it pretty straightforward. But there's a huge backstory here that I was not aware of at the time that this came out on Wednesday, which is not a big deal because if that ever happens, we just talk about it the next week. So here we are. So, okay. So, the scientists who published the paper, essentially the legitimate part of what they did was they used like a new technique for imaging living tissue so that they could visualize these interstitial fluid cavities better than you can see them during usual slide preparation, which you fix the tissue and that sort of evaporates the fluid. It draws out or sucks out the fluid. Probably doesn't evaporate it, but draws it out. And so the tissue is then relatively collapsed. And so they said that they, quote unquote, discovered this new structure, which they were calling a new organ. So there's a few issues with that. And we brought up at the time that calling it an organ, of course, is arbitrary. How do you define an organ? It doesn't seem any less reasonable than calling the skin an organ.
Didn't we do a news item, like when I first started on the show, about how an organ gets to be named an organ?
Yeah, it sounds vaguely familiar.
Yeah, I feel like that. And it's like just a lot of politics. Yeah, it's very political.
But that's kind of a side issue, whether or not you would consider this an organ or not. That is obviously a matter of definition. A lot of the scientific community respond to this by saying, yeah, this is really nothing new. I mean, the imaging, yeah, that's the interesting bit. But the fact that there's interstitial fluid in the connective tissue, nothing new.
This didn't just appear. Like, we never knew this was in the body before.
Yeah, but right. Steve, you said that when the tissue is studied, an artifact of the would be that this stuff would disappear. So we didn't really know the extent of it.
Well, yeah, that's the new bit is the way they were able to image it. But then even like pathologists said, we knew that about that artifact and that there was fluid in this tissue. So this really isn't as new as the authors are spinning it. So I guess it's just a difference in spin about like how significant this is. Those two issues, like how new this is and whether you consider it an organ, not even the biggest part of the revelations that have come out. Yeah. Those are just sort of interesting. It's like, okay, they're overhyping it. And
maybe it's an organ, maybe it's not. Okay.
And that's very common. We see that a lot. Scientists and their press offices and their universities, whatever, there's a tendency to overhype the significance of a new study, which tends to exaggerate our previous ignorance. And then they also hype the significance of it, meaning like by calling it a new organ. That's all pretty par for the course. All right, but here's the here's the real thing that I didn't know about when this came out, but that has come out since.
Stop teasing us. Say it.
Is that the author is a huge component of Wu, a huge fan of Deepak Chopra.
Ah!
And he's using this to say, this is how acupuncture works.
Oh,
no.
Talk about a backstory.
And then a bunch of people, and then they talked about it on Science Friday.
They talked about it on Science Friday. Ira Flatow fail. Huge fail by Ira Flatow.
Ira?
Total fail.
Ira, give us a call.
Completely credulous report about it. So, of course, this has absolutely nothing to do with acupuncture. First of all, do you know how acupuncture works?
It doesn't.
It doesn't.
That's the answer. It doesn't. Why do you keep saying that?
Define
After
work.
3,000 studies plus and decades of research, it's pretty. A few things are pretty clear. One is that meridians and acupuncture points don't exist. It doesn't matter where you stick needles in the body, or even if you stick them in the body, that any alleged effects from acupuncture are just a theatrical placebo. That's been pretty clearly established. There isn't a single indication for which there is robust clinical evidence that of an actual effect beyond placebo with acupuncture. But it is a huge scam. It is absolutely a huge scam. And the research is a perfect example of pseudoscience. It has all of the features of pseudoscience that we talk about on the show in terms of cherry-picking evidence, not properly controlling for variables, over-interpreting studies, not doing proper controls, not really adequately assessing blinding. It's basically rich, the proponents are trying really hard to present noise as if it's data, and there's just tons of p-hacking going on. And really, essentially, this is just a packaging of an elaborate placebo. That is all that it is. And there's basically no plausibility here. But even for just thinking about sticking needles in the skin, forget about the acupuncture points, and that is pure magical nonsense. So, but the thing is, every time something physiological is like stuff is happening or anything new anatomical is shown, some clown says this is how acupuncture works, right? It's like every time we see a star in the universe that we can't explain, it's like that's aliens. It's the same thing, It's just a knee jerk argument from ignorance. So there is nothing in this the study itself doesn't mention acupuncture. There's nothing in it about it at all. It is completely gratuitous. And and it's meaningless. But the author, of the study is using this as an opportunity just to promote his particular, woo that he is apparently enamored of. So and the science itself isn't as good as was initially presented either. I mean, again, I think the imaging technique is the one little legit bit in all of this. But massaging this all into a new organ we didn't know was there, and maybe this is like will explain all kinds of things like how cancer spreads and how acupuncture works. After even just a week of actual scientists with the appropriate expertise looking at the study and the claims, they're like, nah, this is nothing. This is a nothing burger, and this guy's totally overselling these results.
How acupuncture works.
Wow. Who would have thunk?
How the perpetual motion machine works.
Yeah. Right. It's like a physicist finding something new and go, maybe this is where free energy comes from. It's the same kind
right.
of thing.
So Ira, what the hell, Ira? How does he fall for something
Ira has he's a good science communicator in general. He has a fairly consistent blind spot when it comes to alternative medicine. Not uncommon because understanding why alternative medicine is pseudoscience takes a particular set of skills, right? A particular set of expertise that not many people have. So we have a great interview coming up with journalist Mark Linus. So Mark is an environmentalist, but he considers himself a scientific environmentalist. So we're going to chat about that for a while. Joining us now is Mark Linus. Mark, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thanks, Steve.
And Mark, you are a journalist, an author, and also an eco-activist. Do you still consider yourself a current eco-activist or just former? Sometimes I see you described as a former eco-activist.
I'm still very much current. I would self-identify, to use that term, as an environmentalist, in that I still think, as I have always done, that the Earth faces some really catastrophically serious ecological challenges, and we're not even halfway to solving them. And that's been my preoccupation for, I don't know, like 20, 30 years. So absolutely, I'm still an environmentalist, and I'm still an activist, and I'm still a campaigner, because I'm desperately working and pushing to try to change the things that I think need to be changed.
Yeah, and I agree with that basic approach. I mean, I've always considered myself a skeptical environmentalist. Unfortunately, that term has been
don't use that term.
It was ruined. It was ruined, but it's true. I think that accurately
describes
my position.
You know I threw a pie in his face? I am that one.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, no. So that was my last big, my last eco action was a solo venture where I put a big cream pie splat into Bjørn Nomborg's face. But it back in 2001, at exactly the time when he was publishing his book, Skeptical Environmentalist, which I objected to.
Yeah. So unfortunately, the term skeptic has been abused in many quarters, and that is one instance, in my opinion. But the concept that, you know, being an environmentalist, saying, hey, it'd be awfully nice if we had sustainable, you know, practices while we're trying to, you know, really push the human population on this earth and push its resources. But we want to be completely science and evidence based. And why does there often seem to be a problem between those two things? So, for example, earlier in your career, we'll start off talking about this topic. Earlier in your career, you were decidedly anti-GMO, anti-genetically modified organisms. But then over your career, you flipped. So tell us about that.
Well, your premise was that that the environmental movement isn't science-based. And I think that's largely correct. But then it didn't come about because of science. It came about because of almost like an ideological reaction to modernity and industrialism. So when we were young Earth Firsters and we sat around the campfire, we sang songs about, you know, the death of corporations and, you know, the return to the wild, as it were. So that kind of a fantasy of turning the clock back and somehow returning to a, you know, an underpopulated planet where capitalism and industrialism are things of the, you know, things of the distant past, is central to the, at least the radical part of the environmental movement I was involved with, that central to its DNA. So while I can tell you the story of my change of mind specifically on GMOs, I think also I've had to admit to myself and others that I've had a change of worldview. I mean, I would now describe myself as a progressive. I believe in progress. I believe that things can and to some extent have got better, and that science and technology have the power to change things for the better. Whereas I think in the past, I and most probably current environmentalists tended to think that science makes things worse, and that each time you try and fix a problem, you come up with a bigger problem. And hence you hear the invocations of, I don't know, thalidomide or Bhopal, or things that have clearly gone wrong with science and technology, raised as reasons why we should essentially stop all innovation.
So that's interesting. So you think that core to the environmental movement is this worldview that science itself is part of the problem?
Yes, I think so. And I would locate the environmental movement, I mean, obviously it's a broad spectrum and lots of people thinking lots of different things, but if I was going to generalize, I would locate it as part of the romantic capital R reaction against the Enlightenment and against that kind of concept of modernity. In some ways, it's a very modern movement because it's a post-industrial, post-materialist movement. It only comes about in countries and places where people have already sufficiency. You don't find many hungry environmentalists. But that being said, it's very clear what it seeks. And it seeks the return, well, the protection of nature, stopping pollution, the idea that we can return to some kind of idyllic, you know, existence. And it also has this idea that Mother Nature knows best, that that humans will inevitably mess things up, that we're not as clever as we think we are, that we shouldn't intrude on natural ecosystems, and that nature should be left undisturbed. And I think that's a very different worldview from the scientific one, which is, you know, that you can understand the world empirically, that you can take an evidence-based view of how to address issues and solve problems, and that humans are actually clever. So there's a kind of exceptionalism to humans. So I think this is very, very deep stuff, very fundamental stuff, really, about the worldview of where humans are in the cosmos. So it's not just about, and I think I try and point this out to people when we have arguments about, and they say, well, why are people against GMOs when the science is so clear? But, you know, to them, the science is not the issue. The issue is humans shouldn't be doing this. Humans shouldn't be intruding at all on the genetics of plants and animals.
But of course, we've been doing that for thousands of years.
I know, of course. But that's the science again. And that's not the point. See, we've been doing it for thousands of years as part of, in some ways, because it's been done by trial and error rather than in a laboratory, that's okay. You know, that still counts as almost working within nature. So that you can have this concept. A lot of anti-GMO people will talk about, you know, like indigenous crops or old farmer preferred varieties, things like that, which should be protected. Therefore, we should never have any innovation in crop breeding. So the idea then that there's something natural, something authentic out there, which is being sullied tampered with, polluted by direct human interference, particularly when that is using modern technologies, which is especially artificial because it's in the lab, it's got the, you know, the petri dish, the test tube. So if you look at you know, the archetypal GMO image of the tomato with the syringe injecting colored liquid, you can see what the imagery is there of something natural being forcibly injected, forcibly you know, manipulated with something artificial. And I think that in some ways does get to the heart of what the objections are.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that it's definitely one part of it is the appeal to nature fallacy, the idea that nature is always better and anything that feels artificial. Again, there's not really a strict operational definition. It's usually just a gut feeling. Anything that looks or feels scientific or artificial or technological is necessarily bad. And there's absolutely this moral dimension to it, right?
Right. And you can see these movements in medicine as well. And again, yes, it is often centered around the naturalistic fallacy, but the idea that herbal remedies or, you know, the whole naturopath phenomenon, which I know you're well across, I think is that's the medical equivalent of what's happening in food. So you can sort of see organic and natural or ecological stuff in food as the kind of homeopathy naturopath of the medical side of things. So I think they're very much based on the same kinds of motivations. We need to return to nature. Nature knows best. Humans are intruding and polluting and destroying the, you know, the natural balance. So the idea of balance in nature is also quite fundamental, even though that's not science-based either. So the thing is, none of these are all pre-molecular biology, pre-Darwinian concepts in many ways. The idea, I think, that of essentialism. So the I think the kind of original sin of transgenics as a technology is this side. Is this the moving of genes between unrelated species? You know, the proverbial fish gene in the strawberry. I mean, people just find that abhorrent. Most people find that abhorrent, actually, because they don't think that genes are just genes. They're not just, you know, sequences of DNA, really, who cares? And that we all share lots of genes, and the genes aren't immutable, and they're the evolution is changing these things all the time, and you've got horizontal gene transfer and so on. So that's what modern science tells us. But what people feel is that species have always been different and separate, and there's something essential in a species, which is its essence, right? And that that's somehow being altered and somehow being polluted or transgressed by genetic engineering.
Yeah, it is very pre-Darwinian. I agree with that.
So what's the right course to take then? I mean, Mark, are you changing like the way that you handle trying to educate people because of this?
Well, I'm not sure you could even call it trying to educate people. That's a bit too, I mean, I don't want to sound too arrogant. The problem isn't that people are ignorant. I mean, yes, it would be great if everyone had more of an understanding of molecular biology and, you know, even knew what GMO stood for. But that's not what's going on here. I mean, no one objected, to give you a different example, no one objected to mutation breeding back in the 50s when they were using atomic radiation to cause lots of mutations and then induce phenotypic changes, some of which happen to be desirable, right? That's like random genetic engineering with all sorts of unintended consequences probably. And yet there was no objection at all. And when it came to more modern genetic engineering, the random mutational stuff was grandfathered in and was excluded from any regulation. And you could still have organic crops, which are bred mutationally using atomic radiation. So why was that okay? So none of this is logical, and it's not science-based either. It what's happened is that you've had a politicized controversy, which has been fermented, if you like, by particular ideological interest groups for their particular reasons.
So it's interesting that you bring up organics. I was going to go there as well, because while I agree that what you're describing is one component, and I think they are the most radical, if you will, anti-GMO or environmentalists, one that have a worldview that includes 90% of humans dying off. They're not necessarily open about that, but intrinsic to their view is that their return to sort of the pre-industrial age requires a massive die-off of people. But anyway,
I'm not sure they'd admit that, actually. I think the fallacy is, and to me it's a delusion, but I think most of them believe that you can support the current human population just using organic farming, and that we can just wish away the chemicals, and that farmers only use chemicals because they're evil and the chemicals companies force them to. So there is a deluded worldview, I think, which permits this level of denialism. And I think that's what underpins it. I don't in any way think that there's a kind of oh, yes, let's kill off 90% of the world's population. They just want to have their cake and eat it.
Yeah, I think it's all out there. I've seen that. I've seen people, when you push them against the wall, they said, well, yeah, the population will naturally decrease over time, you know, if we do this. But the point I was getting to is that I think there are different flavors, though. I think maybe not everyone has that particular worldview. And I do get the sense that the organic lobby, if you will, they're a little bit more calculating in what they're deciding to approve and oppose. And this is the sense that I have. Like, for as you say, they're okay with mutation farming, with forced hybridization, with patented hybrid seeds. They're basically okay using all the things that they say they're against, and they have to know it. The people who are, you know, more like who are part of the organic lobby and actually know what they're talking about, at least in terms of the facts, they're not just misinformed or confused about the fact that pretty much every seed planted by a farmer can't be reused, and it has to be purchased every year and is probably patented as well. So to me, that always smelled of just one brand attacking and demonizing another brand because it's good for business.
Yeah, I think there's an element of that. But if you focus too much on the commercial imperatives, I think you'll miss the extent to which this is an ideological movement. And I think it's that first and foremost. Yes, it's now become a multi-billion dollar industry. And you've got Whole Foods and you've got, you know, some of these big organic companies, which are owned by some of the largest multinationals in the world. But I still think it is at heart an ideological movement and an ideological rejection of what is seen as you know, industrial chemical based agriculture. And that's why it's so popular. I think if it was just a marketing scam, it wouldn't have anything like the emotional appeal and the attraction that it's managed to achieve in at least in rich country societies.
Well, I think the marketing scam is exploiting the ideological movement in a lot of ways, which we see in a lot of contexts as well. Like in alternative medicine, that's a great analogy because the appeal to nature fallacy is there as well. And you have those elements which are just exploiting fear-mongering about technological medicine, fear-mongering about toxins, ideological appeal to nature. But there's a corporation behind it who's just trying to sell snake oil a lot of the times. So there's this, you know, behind the scenes kind of marriage of those two things.
Yeah, I'm sure that's the case. In some ways, even though it's not my area, I regard the snake oil sales people in the medical side more harshly because I think they do direct provable damage. I actually think so while there's nothing of value at all in my view to homeopathy or these many of these other alternative medical treatments. I think with organic farming, actually, there is value there. The idea that we should be more cognizant of the ecology of farmland, the idea that a healthy soil is important. Some things that you know, just the critique of the overuse of chemicals. I mean, that certainly has been an issue since Silent Spring. It's been well recognized, and it's still an issue today. Pesticides are overused, and there are still big problems from runoff of chemical fertilizers and so on. Now, partly these are trade-offs with having an industrialized agricultural system, which can feed the current world population, which is quite an achievement. And were you to get rid of all chemicals tomorrow, then you would certainly not be able to feed even half the world's population. So the organic advocates don't recognize those trade-offs, and they try and explain them away. But I don't think the corollary of what we're saying is that we have to pretend that all is well with modern agriculture, because it isn't.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you could say the same thing about modern medicine or modern anything, pretty much. There's always trade-offs. There's always complications. It's complicated. And we're trying to push the ball forward. And I do think the ideology gets in the way. Like, for example, I'm very much a proponent of sustainable farming. Absolutely. And there's a lot of things that we need to consider in terms of best practices. I get annoyed at the organic movement because I think that they're actually counterproductive to even their own ideas. You know, they're trying to promote, they have taken the mantle of sustainable farming, but then they've sullied it with a very narrow ideology, and they're actually doing things which are counterproductive to sustainable farming, like opposing GMOs.
Yeah, and I think actually it's worse in developing countries. So where this really bugs me is in Africa or in, you know, South Asia, where you've got all these organic so-called ecological NGOs, all of which are supported by donor funds from Western countries, and they are sort of importing this organic ideology into the context of farming systems where food security is still a real issue, because the levels of productivity are so low, and you've got farmers, subsistence farmers mainly, who are working desperately hard with very few inputs, very little capital, and they can't feed their families. And to tell them that organic is best and they shouldn't be using chemicals is not just inappropriate, it's unjust, particularly if you're stopping them using better seeds, which could, you know, survive a drought or, you know, resist pests or diseases. So that's where I find this injustice is at its most extreme, and where I get most upset and angry about it.
Yeah, I agree. And that's where I would disagree with your statement that they're not as bad as the snake oil salesman, because like opposing, for example, yellow rice,
golden rice. I was just did
golden
a blog,
rice. Yeah.
Just did a blog post about this today, because there's a, it's called the Stop Golden Rice Network, which just had a meeting in a luxury hotel in Manila. And they've got 30 NGOs, most of which are again supported by donor funding, including one of them from the Swedish government, Overseas Aid Agency. And they're supporting this so-called peasant farmer group to go out there and try and stop golden rice reaching, you know, hundreds of thousands of children who are suffering, who lose their sight, and many of whom die. So, yes, that is a very extreme example of what happens when GMO ideology, you know, and the kind of that kind of environmental philosophy turns pathological, if you like.
Yeah, that's pretty direct harm, in my opinion. Or Vandana Shiva, who literally said she would rather have Indians starve than eat GMO, you know, food donated after, you know, a tsunami.
Cyclone, yeah, cyclone, yeah. Don't get me started on Vandana Shiva.
But you can't.
She called me a rapist, so I think I have yeah. a.
Well, you're trying to rape the earth, right?
Well, specifically, what she said was when I made a speech, you know, saying that GMOs were okay, and I changed my mind on this issue. She said it was like saying rapists should be free to rape. So. I thought that, I mean, not, obviously that was offensive and inappropriate, but I thought it was interesting as well, because the idea of, you know, what rape stands for, she really sees it as a kind of technological rape of the earth, somehow that there's this abominable intrusion of nature, you know, being carried out, of Mother Nature being raped by technology. So I think in some ways it was a window into the real core of her ideology that she said that.
And you can't, you cannot argue with that once somebody's mind has been, you know, found, it finds itself in that place. You know, like you were saying before, it's not about education at this point. It really is about people's core belief systems.
No, but give her points for being consistent. She's also said that she opposes everything that's happened since the European Enlightenment, so that we've learned nothing over the last 500 years. So she does at least fully reject science as a method, and she's a full, I would say, full-scale relativist. She believes that science is just another belief system, no more or no less valuable than previous ones in other cultures. So that's kind of eco-postmodernism taken, you know, from a, well, she tries to project that as a sort of authentic Indian viewpoint, but I think actually it's a very modern phenomenon, very Western in many ways too.
Yeah, in my opinion, you know, Vandana Shiva is the poster child for somebody who thinks they are righteous but is actually evil. If you look at her actual like positions and what she is doing, it's actually extremely harmful. She has attitudes which I would characterize as morally evil, but she's doing it with the full belief that she is a good and righteous person who's doing what's best for her people. And that's the power, I think, of ideology.
Well, I'm sure a lot of damage over history shows has been done through people who believe they're doing the right thing. You know, if you look at what her ideology is, I would characterize it as fully reactionary, in the sense that she wants to defend peasant agriculture. But you think, what does that actually mean? Well, A, it doesn't apply to her when she's traveling first class, you know, jetting around the world to give speeches to Western audiences as this great guru. But B, she's saying that, and she calls herself a feminist, she's saying that women in village India should stay working, you know, in their traditional fields. They should not have any additional life choices. They should basically stay in a life of drudgery in a, well, a very ossified patriarchal society. Now, to me, that's not just like a Marie Antoinette point of view. That's a fully conservative reactionary point of view, and because it denies the agency of some of the poorest people in the world. So I'm happy in my own ideology to oppose that and say, no, I'm a progressive. I believe that people should be able to make choices, should be able to change their lives, should be able to decide for themselves what kind of future they want.
Yeah, I totally agree. And ironically, you know, even though she isn't Western, in a lot of ways, that reflects the privilege that we often see, where you have, you know, privileged members of Western developed countries dictating to, as you said, like poor members of developing countries, what they can and cannot do based upon, you know, their own ideology, so they could feel better about themselves. And I agree, either really fully delusional or just incredibly incurious, because, you know, they are advocating a position that can lead to, you know, poverty, death, blindness, whatever, in these people. If they really cared about these people, they couldn't possibly take the positions that they do.
If you've got to look at what she's doing, she's telling, I mean, she's very popular in the West. She can charge $40,000 a speech, according to her speaker agency. But what she's doing is telling guilt-stricken post-colonial Western audiences what they want to hear, which is that the peasants in India are happy as they are, that modernization is bad, that you in Western countries should be feeling guilty about being modernized, and you should be looking to go back to the land and, you know, back to sort of a medieval culture, which is what they still have in India, and that's what we seek to protect. So it's, as I say, that's why I would say it's a romantic worldview, because it's fully in opposition to everything that's happened since the Industrial Revolution.
Mark, what projects are you working on now?
I am, well, apart from selling my GMO book, I'm about to embark on a new version of 6 Degrees, which is my book on climate change, which I did way back in 2007. So I'm going to do a kind of 2020 update of that, because a lot's changed in the science, and people keep asking me almost every day, what's the future got in store in terms of the climate science as we know it? So I'm going to spend another couple of years going back and seeing just how, you know, how catastrophic is our future according to both where we are in terms of emissions and what the science says.
And what's the title of your GMO book?
The title of GMO book is Seeds of Science, Why We Got It So Wrong on GMOs.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a fascinating discussion.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm honored. I'm a big fan of the podcast, so it's great, and always fascinating to talk to you both.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week, and while at first blush it may seem that this theme is unfair, I don't think so. The theme is animals of the Amazon.
Crap.
Fix.
I'm going to be like the worst at this.
Are you guys ready
No.
to learn all about... There's just so many of them. The fact that Kara was there like really isn't that much.
Oh, there's advantage. Dozens of them.
Dozens. All right, here we go. Item number one. The pirarucu is a large carnivorous fish that grows up to 3 meters long and has teeth on its tongue. The cyclosa spider is tiny, but it will build a large decoy spider replica in its web out of leaves, twigs, and dead insects. And item number three, pink river dolphins get their pink color from the shrimp that is their primary food. Jay, go first.
The Pikachu is a large carnivorous...
With a lightning bolt. And
it's 3 meters long and has teeth on its tongue. I learned this from Perry. Stuff like this, you got to just say yes. Okay. It's freaky, but I'm not gonna say what? It has teeth on its tongue. Yes, some weird animal has teeth on its tongue. I'm moving on to the next one.
But that's the point. These are all weird animals.
Right. The cyclosa spider. He literally builds a decoy version of himself. Now, is this a larger version or is it the same size as him?
Yes. No,
it is a large version. That's really cool. God, I hope that's true, because it's just really cool that a spider would do that. Yeah, I find this to be believable just because I could see an animal evolving this, odd behavior, but it would work. You know, well, like, let's think about it. It makes a decoy. Okay, let me think this through. It makes a decoy on its web. To do what, though? To make other insects or animals think that it's waiting there? Is it trying to lure something in or make something go away? Wish I knew the answer to that. Okay, and this pink river dolphins get their pink color from the shrimp that is their primary food. I know of other animals whose color comes from their food, so I see no reason to think that these guys don't exist, even though I'm not – I just can't – I got a little tickler, you know when you have a tickler? Little memory back there bouncing around. No, not that. I threw that away many years ago. I'm going to unfortunately say that the Cyclosis spider, I think that is the fake.
Alrighty, Bob.
Yeah, I'm going to go with the teeth on the tongue. So that's good. The dolphin color, at first I was pretty damn skeptical. I mean, it's so reminiscent of the pink flamingo, right? That they get their pink color from their food. We've talked about that on the show. But that's kind of like feathers. That's not skin. But then I was thinking that you could people have had their skin dyed from their diet, like if they ate like way too much like beta carotene and stuff, you could actually change the color of your skin. So yeah, it could happen. So I guess I've got more problems with the spider thing. I mean, I used to know a lot about spiders. In fact, in the fifth grade, I got an A++ on my spider report.
Many times.
Many swear to God, A++.
Bob's favorite book growing up. Bob's favorite book was Charlotte's Web.
Oh, man, yeah.
It was a good book.
And that's because I love Spider-Man, so I was attracted to anything with spiders. So, yeah, that doesn't make a hell of a lot of sense. I mean, you could put a big spider in the middle of the web. You're making your web even, less attractive. So sure, you could misdirect and put the focus on the big fake spider while you lurk on the side, ready to leap. I mean, what's the other spider going to do? And I'm kind of thinking I would have heard of that if it's true, because this is so damn cool, a spider replica. So yeah, I'm going to say that's fiction.
Okay, Evan.
Hope not.
I'm going to join the guys. I think what maybe instead is going on with this spider is that instead of building a large decoy spider replica, it's building something else, something that might attract other food sources into the web, and then it'll, lunge on it or grab it when it's close enough.
Eat its Sammy's
pincer range or whatever it is. So I think I'll agree with the guys. I think the spider one's the fiction.
All right, Kara, I had you go last.
There will be no sweep.
Oh.
The Cyclosa is absolutely a decoy spider. That's what it's called, the decoy spider. And my friend Phil Torres helped discover and name it. That's why I know about it.
Can I change
I've actually
answer?
Seen it the in the forest. Fuck. I took pictures of it, but they turned out really shitty. I was trying to find them while we were talking, but they're really blurry.
I still don't believe
they're
it.
They're really cool. Well, I'm sure that Steve will tell you all
just
about
some
it.
Decoy pictures,
but
maybe.
It's really rare that they have six or eight looking legs, so it really looks like a spider. It's much more common that it's a singular line that they build into their web. But yeah, sometimes they build these large structures, and the spiders are super tiny. Anyway, we haven't finished yet, so it's between the Pirarucu and the pink river dolphin. Where I was in the Amazon, there are no pink river dolphins. They're in the larger portion of the Amazon, so I didn't get to see any. The Pirarucu, from what I remember, is a really big redfish that's a big meat source, but also that they have these weird tongues that the locals use to process seeds. And so maybe it has teeth on it. Maybe that's why they use it that way, these dried tongues that look like pumice stones.
Jesus.
I know. See, that's what happens when you hang out in the rainforest with a bunch of ecologists. I'm thinking it's the pink river dolphin one. That I just think that it's not shrimp. I think there's some other explanation for the pink pigment, both in the river dolphin and the the bird that we saw. It was a really beautiful spoonbill that they said was actually quite rare to see. That was out.
The roseate spoonbill, or was it?
Could be, I don't know. But it was lovely white with a lot of pink accent, with a big, gorgeous spoonbill.
Sounds like a roseate.
They said
spoonbill.
That they're migratory, and it was really rare to see them when we saw them, so that was kind of exciting. But one thing I will say, which is not in either of these, or in any of these, is that unfortunately they can't eat much of the fish that comes out of the Amazon anymore because it's so toxic from runoff from all of the illegal gold mining that's happening in the area.
I would think so.
Yeah, so like at the Eco Lodges where we were, they don't even feed seafood. They only will feed, I think, like canned tuna and stuff that's flown in. But otherwise, none of the meals actually involve seafood. So yeah, huge bummer. But I'm going to go with the pink river dolphin. I'm going to say there's a different reason that it's pink.
All right, so Karen and I picked pink river dolphins. Right. Very good, very good.
Evan, the Jedi mind trick only works on the weak-minded.
Damn it.
All right, so you all agree on number one, so we'll start there. The Pururuku is a large carnivorous fish that grows up to 3 meters long and has teeth on its tongue. You all think this one is science, and this one is science.
Yes.
Yay.
Well, yay.
The good part of this game is that you're always right on some level.
Yeah, in fact, the names of the animals all partly give away the answer. So, yeah, this is in the group Osteoglossidae.
Oh, there you go.
The bony-tongued fishes.
Yeah.
Right. That'll do it.
Awesome.
Yeah. And Kara is right. They use a dried tongue from this fish to process seeds. Basically like a scraper.
Scratch their backs.
Yeah. It's like a grater, you know. Right. I don't know if you'd be a good back scratcher.
Might be.
It's a weird looking fish. Kind of has like a flattened out tail and a very, very short tail fin. Very big. I mean, up to, 10 feet, 3 meters long. Huge. It does say it is an important source of protein for the locals, but maybe that's not true.
No, I mean, I think it's still true. It's just... unfortunately, it's getting to be harder and harder to eat that. I'm sure people still do because they have to.
Okay. The Cyclosa spider is tiny, but it will build a large decoy spider replica in its web out of leaves, twigs, and dead insects. You guys all think this one is fiction. Kara is pretty confident that this one is science.
Uh-oh.
And this one is... science.
Yay! You picked one that one of my best friends helped describe.
It is, of course, it is the decoy building spider. The Cyclosa is just the genus, but I couldn't say there was no other name for it. The name is the decoy building spider.
And that's what we all called it in the forest. Like, oh, look, it's a Cyclosa. Ooh, I found a Cyclosa web.
Yeah. But it's just one member of the genus Cyclosa.
Yeah.
And apparently there's another one in the Philippines that also builds decoys.
Well, and that's the thing. That one was discovered first, and then Phil found the one in Peru, and they were like, holy crap, it's the same genus.
Right. Yeah, which is cool. So they're not sure why it builds it, but they think it's to scare away predators. It is a tiny, like 5 millimeter little spider. But the decoy's huge.
Yeah, it's itty-bitty.
And I've seen some pictures of them. Nice. That looks pretty good. It looks like an eight-legged little spider on the web. You get a glance at that, your immediate thing, at least I'm sure they're showing like the best examples of it. But
well, and those best examples that they're showing, I think were probably taken by Phil.
I'm sure,
if you
of
look
course
again,
they were.
Yeah, look at the photo credit underneath. It's so cool.
Yeah,
exactly. This one says photo courtesy Larry Reeves. Do you know Larry Reeves?
Larry Reeves is the researcher in the Philippines.
Oh, that would okay. Look at the film. Uh-huh.
Steve, have you ever heard? Have you ever heard of the screaming spider?
That'll do it.
All right. All that means that pink river dolphins get their pink color from the shrimp that is their primary food. Kara sniffed this out as the fake.
Yay!
There are pink river dolphins, and man, they are pink.
Mm-hmm.
Those suckers are pink. They're adorable. But they do not get their pink color from shrimp because they eat mainly fish. They eat lots of stuff, but I didn't even see shrimp on their long list of things that they eat.
I don't think there is a lot of shrimp there.
Yeah, probably not.
Yeah.
There are probably some. I mean, probably the roseate gets their color from shrimp, I would imagine.
I know fish
do.
They were in Las Vegas, they'd eat shrimp, right, Steve?
Exactly.
But the dolphins get it because their skin is thin and translucent, and it's basically their capillaries.
Oh.
It's
that makes sense. Ooh,
for
cool.
For that reason, they will blush. Their color will change with emotion.
Oh, wow. That is cool.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Right. So it's basically their blood flow. You should look at pictures of them. Pink river dolphins are very adorable. Yeah, they are. The freshwater dolphins are interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're gorgeous.
Well, good job, Kara. I would have been surprised if you didn't get it.
Yeah,
this week,
what?
Yes, that would have been embarrassing.
Ever, Kara.
All right, Evan, give us a quote.
Do not train children to learning by force and harshness, but direct them to it by what assures their minds, so that you may be better able to discover with accuracy the peculiar bent of the genius of each. And that is from Plato in The Republic.
Cool, Plato.
Great book.
Plato. As I was looking up some quotes about scholarship and learning, and I stumbled upon that one. So, makes me want to go back and read The Republic.
All right, so, guys, our book production is moving along nicely. So
yes,
we have our final cover, which you could see on Amazon and elsewhere, where you can pre-order either the ebook or the hardcover. And we just got the internal design for us to pick over and approve and make, you know, tiny tweaky suggestions. But look, I thought I would go over some of the chapters. The book is divided into different sections. There's one section is neuropsychological humility, and that has chapters on memory, on hyperactive agency detection. You guys all know what that is. Of course, hypnagogia, ideomotor effect, all the things in which all the glitchy things that our brain does. And then there's a section on metacognition, which is thinking about thinking, critical thinking, right? This would has a discussions on things like the Dunning-Kruger effect, confirmation bias, fundamental attribution error, anomaly hunting, data mining, all kinds of stuff like that. And then there's a section on science versus pseudoscience, where we talk about things like Occam's razor, the demarcation problem, p-hacking, witch hunts, placebo effects. And then iconic examples of pseudoscience and deception, the clever Hans effect, the Hawthorne effect, cold reading, free energy. I learned stuff about all of these topics when we were doing the book, when we were researching it. Like we went deeper on these than than we had before. NRAs is a chapter on NRAs. The story is so much more interesting than what I thought it was. Very interesting.
And then Stephen's favorite chapter he wrote, How to Be Cool Like Me.
Yeah. Oh, that's the biggest chapter. That's the meat of the book.
But
there is a fun section on what we call adventures and skepticism, where each of us writes a chapter about some topic that we confronted, where we had sort of a skeptical arc. And we even have a chapter in there by Perry. Perry's only contribution to the book. And then skepticism and the media, and then and death by pseudoscience, of course. And then changing yourself and the world. There's a lot of stuff in that book.
A lot.
496 pages.
Or thereabouts. Thereabouts. So the current estimate, depending on exactly how it shakes out. But
it's a very specific estimate.
Yeah. Well, we wanted to basically have this be like everything you need to know about critical thinking and scientific skepticism to be a good skeptic, right? We did obviously, there's still a ton of little topics to cover. There's some things in here that are representative, but we basically covered everything you need to know. That was the goal. And, I think that this would be a good introduction into scientific skepticism for anybody who is not familiar with it. And it would be a good reference for people who are already into it, but they want a thorough, treatment walkthrough of, here's it. This is everything.
Yeah, it fills in the blanks, even for us, you were saying, Steve, like doing the research and editing the book and doing all the work to put all of this data together. Like I didn't realize until when we were done, I'm like, wow, I still had so many holes in my understanding of things and just my overall knowledge. So that's why I think even for a seasoned scientific skeptic,
it'll plug the
hole. There's good stuff in there.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is the name of the book. So just search on that on Amazon or Barnes & Noble, or I'm not sure where else it's available, but it'll come up. And we do appreciate it if you pre-order the book, because that will help get the book noticed, get it on bestseller lists. We want to books either take off in the first week or they don't, and pre-orders are the best way to make that happen.
Please.
In 97 days, Nexus 2018 is happening, guys. July 12th to the 15th.
Gosh. I can't wait.
Yeah, so general registration has opened. We have all the info about the conference up online now. You can see our complete list of speakers. You can see all the workshops, all the nighttime activity. This is going to be one hell of a year. We've got a lot of Patreon members coming in as well, which I'm really excited. We're going to meet meet and greet. I'm going to be setting that up with a lot of the listeners. I think that's going to be a lot of fun. We have the SGU private show and a couple of other things that we're trying to pull together that we can't say right now, but if they happen, it'll be really cool. So please do come to Nexus 2018. We will all be there. And, you know, if you aren't, then you won't know how cool it is to be there, right? I mean, it's a pretty simple formula.
Jay, yes. Jay, I really like my workshop topic for this year. So for the workshop, I'm going to be talking about how to read a scientific paper.
Oh, finally.
Oh, yeah.
Finally.
Yay.
Yes. Yes, yeah, so we can all use that.
Yeah, after that talk, you will have some idea how to evaluate the quality and the actual findings of a scientific paper, and at the and also how to read a science news item about a scientific paper, right? So it's beautiful. Not just, even if you don't find your way back to the original paper itself, you're just reading journalists write around, I will tell you how to think about that, how to evaluate it, and like how to really dig down. So I think that's a good core skill set to have. All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
You're welcome, Steve.
Good to be joined to you.
And until next week, by the way, next week is SGU episode number 666.
Oh boy, we got to do something. What are we
gonna
do?
Someone has to do something.
We'll see. We'll see. Well, until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.